Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know what I did this past week for the first time? I turned on the furnace. And my house feels really good. It's warm today, so the furnace is down to almost nothing. But if you did that and your furnace turned on, you got yourself a nice warm home, that can look pretty good to small mammals, maybe mice or maybe bats. We'll be talking about that today, among other things, with our two guests, Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie, a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David, a professor, both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension as well. So great to have them along. Jamie, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, David, good to see you again, too.
Likewise, Larry. Thank you.
So they're going to talk about those small critters that might get in your house, but we can also be talking about why you may want to leave your garden cleanup until spring, what's happening with the bird migration. We'll talk about, maybe how you might help the wood turtle, for example. So, and we'll, of course, answer your wildlife questions. So I hope you join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And if you've got a great wildlife photo and a wildlife question, you could also email us. And the email address is ideas@wpr.org. And we always love to see those photos. Well, I have not had a problem. I've lived in this house now for 7 years, and I have yet to have my first mouse, which is saying something.
You better knock on wood, Larry.
That's excellent, but yes, knock on some wood.
However, I was talking to some other people who will remain nameless, who have said that they have already had mice come into their house this fall season. So what's the best way to keep them out of the house?
Well, with the onset of some cooler weather, it is an absolutely perfect time to be doing some preventative measures to keep small animals from getting into your home. So one very important rule here, you know, if you're trapping those mice or squirrels in your attic and releasing them, you are going to continue to have a problem. So you're going to continue to have problems and animals entering your home until you take the time to properly seal off, first of all, identify, and then seal off all the possible entry points. So now is a perfect time to be walking around the exterior of your home and looking for holes or cracks, paying special attention to the eaves, the fascia board, and flashings, and any places where you have damp wood that should really be replaced as well. It harbors insects, which can then encourage other animals to come after those insects. So small holes or cracks, they can be filled with caulk or expandable foam, but if they're large, you may have to replace or repair that entire area. And then also the pipes or utility outlets that you have, you're going to want to cover those as well. And you could do, they make products that go over the top of those outlets, but you could also create your own using hardware cloth. Other entry points that are common, even into your garage, would be the seals around garage doors or walk doors. And then also looking at your windows and the screens. Are they fully functioning? Are they tight? Are there any holes that need to be repaired? Those can quickly be popped off and replaced. So, and then another, again, preventative, Benjamin Franklin, announced that prevention is worth a pound of cure. Solid advice is if you do not have a chimney cap on your chimney, it is well worth the investment to do so. It's likely a matter of time before a raccoon or something else will find that opening and be able to, or try to, den in it. And the cost of hiring somebody to remove a raccoon or a family of raccoons is much more costly than the chimney cap itself.
I was just thinking about three houses ago, I didn't have a chimney cap and a squirrel got in the house and tearing around and ran into the bathroom. And then I discovered under that the vent, there was no vent cover for the heat duct.
Yeah.
And so then it got into the duct system. And I did get to have a heart trap and was able, put some peanut butter in there and got it back out. But
well, and luckily you knew where it was getting in. That can be, you know, the difficult is finding how they're getting in, especially with mice or bats and things that are rather small.
Yeah, because they can get into pretty small holes, maybe the size of a dime, something like that, you know?
Usually we say for bats about 5/8 of an inch.
Yeah,
and,
it's about a
just
dime
a little
size.
A little bit larger than that for mice. As long as an animal can get its head and shoulders through, the rest of the body kind of just slips right on through following the head and shoulders. So think about that type of a size.
You know, Kay in Sauk Prairie has an interesting question about mice, I believe. So as long as we're talking about mice, and then Mary, we'll get to you and Ladysmith. But Kay, what's on your mind?
Well, I sort of have a conflict because I like to feed suet and seed to the birds, but I don't know how far away I need to keep that from the house to not lure mice.
So, Kay, that's a great question and allows me to talk a little bit about removing attractants around your yard, but also in your home, keeping food in air, tight containers, or if you have bird seed you're storing outside, putting it in a metal garbage can, things that rodents and other animals can't get into. But one of the points I wanted to mention is that if you feed birds, and I certainly do too and enjoy it, it's really important to kind of clean up that spilled seed from time to time. Now, there are ground feeding birds like the juncos and the mourning doves that will eat that seed. But when you have a large accumulation of that, it does start to bring in other small mammals, which then may bring in larger mammals that you may or may not be interested in. So to answer your question, if you're concerned about mice traveling from the bird feeder to the home, you likely already have mice within that area. So in the footprint of your home, that is certainly well within the home range of a mouse. So if it's a half acre, a third acre lot, you're not going to be able to push that bird feeder far enough. But you can check those entry points, and you can clean up that seed as it accumulates to help reduce that issue.
The other thing I'll add is all very good points, by the way, Jamie. The other thing is a lot of people keep their garage doors open, especially in nice weather. And I know, for example, we have a nice wood pile in our garage, so we can go out in the wintertime and don't have to go all the way outside. So wood piles, if you have dog food or cat food or bird seed in garbage containers in garages, make sure that it's in a metal container. If you can move that wood pile out of your garage, all those things are attractants that are going to bring mice into the garage, and that's just one step closer to getting into your house. So think not just, as Jamie mentioned, about outside your house, but think about what might be going on in your garage area as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. Oh, we lost our other caller. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. Email us at ideas@wpr.org with a question and or photo. Mike sent a photo, oh, my goodness, of a bunch of dead mice. And he set up a trap in his bait shop, and he caught 16 mice in the trap since Monday of last week, 9 the first cold night last week. Do they travel in packs?
Well, so mice are in the rodent family, and rodents are very social animals, so they do live in a family group. They are prolific breeders, so they'll have multiple offspring in over the course of a year, and it's not unusual to have that many mice in a general location. You know, mice are a small mammal, as are voles and moles and all sorts of mm-hmm. other things like that. And all those small mammals, they provide the foundation of that that food pyramid for everything above them that eats them, all the other predators. So, you know, there's got to be a plethora of these small mammals to support all the other animals above them. And so it's not uncommon to have a lot of mice in a small general area.
Wow. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. Let's take another call from Mary in Madison next. Mary, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. I just wanted to just make a comment. You were talking about the chimney cats. I don't want to go over, you know, back up or anything. But another thing to remember about them, and we had an unfortunate incident when a mother raccoon decided to make a nest or whatever in the chimney, because she got in and we were renting this house, and it ended the next morning. We had our carbon monoxide we had the bells going off and the whistles, and it turned out that's why, you know. So it's just really important to, like you said, keep those get those chimneys checked and making sure that the covers are on.
Yeah, I'm glad you called, Mary. That's a great reminder, isn't it, David?
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, those chimney caps are, what, about $25 or something like that compared to at least a $100 or $200 house call by somebody with wildlife control. I had a colleague of mine who did a study a number of years ago, and I believe it was Hartford, Connecticut, but he looked at all houses, you know, throughout Hartford, and I think 85% of the houses that did not have a chimney cap on them had a raccoon in the chimney. And then once they took the chimney or the raccoons out of the chimney, put a chimney cap on that chimney, that they radio tracked the raccoons, and like 67% of the raccoons went back to another chimney without a chimney cap on it. So they are, you know, raccoons are cavity nesters, and they're not stupid animals. So those chimneys are kind of a nice artificial cavity for them.
And here's the carbon monoxide. Yeah. So, I mean, your absolutely. Own health is at stake yeah. here, yeah,
absolutely.
Jamie.
Yes. Yes, and they're particularly habituated to humans, too. So yeah. to be in neighborhoods and urban areas, they certainly yep. figure they're... you know, find yep. those habitats.
They're great climbers and yep. Yeah, very, very adept animals.
And so, Mary, thanks again for that point. I really appreciate it. We'll take another call. Terry in DeForest, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. A couple years ago, I had a problem with mice getting in under the hood of my car, and they died, and they were stinky, and insurance covered the repairs, which were extensive because they chewed on wires and things. But since that time, I've seen on the internet that if you put a half a bar of Irish Spring soap or something in your glove box, that you can avoid that problem. Is there any truth to that, or is that just an internet myth?
So, Terry, I've also been the victim of a nest within a within the hood of a car, and those are typically going to be white-footed and deer mice, our native mice that get in there, and they can chew on wires, cache food, build their nests. They really can cause quite a ruckus. So yeah. What we typically tell folks with some of those methods that you read about or hear about, whether it be juicy fruit gum for moles or bars of soap for either mice or deer, is one, if it's working for you, keep doing it. That's fantastic. But typically the research, those types of repellents or I guess homemade remedies haven't really worked out in the research studies. But in your case, what I would suggest is being careful about leaving the garage door open, as David had mentioned, and maybe your car is parked outside. But also just, you know, maybe you're going to have to just check on a weekly basis to make sure you don't have the start of a nest if it's not parked in a garage. If it's parked in a garage, you can run a trap line within the, you know, in the garage to keep them
like
at
Scott
bay.
Craven does.
Yes, right. Yes.
Yep. Scott has great luck at that.
And, you know, go and look at those entry points again and the seals on your walk doors and your garage door.
And it's hard for me to imagine. She mentioned a bar of Irish Spring in your glove box. I can't imagine how that would keep mice out of your engine area.
Well, yeah. The other one I've heard was bounce fabrics
dryer sheets,
but you want to be careful about the heat that engine generates too.
Well, that's why they're probably telling people to put them in their glove box.
Yeah. Yeah. How is that smell going to...
You won't get any mice in your glove box. But
well, that's because they can't open the box. If they could open the glove box, they'd probably be in there even with the soap.
Oh, boy. Thanks, Terry. Appreciate the call. Joel in Lagerville?
Lagerville.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
You might have just covered it. I don't know. But I'm in the process of trying a botanical rodent repellent that comes in packets that smells a lot like strong pine. And I had some success for them for like 3 days, and now I'm getting mice in the traps right near them.
Yeah.
Put any faith in them? Or?
So this is, Joel, this is, I'm assuming, supposed to be an odor repellent. Not that they're necessarily biting into the packet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So odor repellents are more hit or miss than our contact or taste repellents for a variety of reasons. But number one, depending on where it is, you know, that animal is most likely approaching it from upwind at some point, and so anything upwind that is not going to be as effective as if it is downwind. A lot of times, if you get some kind of precipitation, that can at least mute, if not altogether, erase the odor that's coming out of that. And generally, animals, you know, especially in a urban type environment. Think about how many human-oriented smells these animals are exposed to every single day. And the idea behind some of these odor repellents is to try to give them something that's foreign to them that kind of catches them off guard or makes them a little leery about being there. And it's just such a hit or miss type issue. So I think depending on what you're trying to do, what kind of damage you're trying to stop, that most likely the most effective management tool, if you're not opposed to trapping them, is to trap them. And usually a kill trap. But there are certainly live traps out there as well. If your ethics are not in line with killing those animals,
I've run many trap lines.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I would just get some. I would get some, you know, wood based mouse traps, bait it with peanut butter. As it sounds like you're doing that already, and I would not waste any more money on the botanical rodent repellent.
Yep. The other thing that struck me about that, Joel, too, was the fact, okay, they avoided it for like 3 days. The scent was probably stronger those first few days,
yeah.
And then they realized that there wasn't any issue with being around it, and so they moved
and
right in.
And a lot of the scent-based repellents work okay, or if they're going to work, they're going to work in a confined area, so when we use mothballs or naphthalene, but when you get to an open environment, that scent is really dissipated.
Keep trapping, Joel. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Glendale, we'll get to you in just a minute, but just a reminder to you, we're talking about all things wildlife. We've certainly zeroed in on the rodents, but we can take other questions as well with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin.
Today.
Yeah.
Were we supposed to
know
something else?
No.
That's a joke.
Oh, Kate Archer Kent, our engineer today. She's doing a great job. Jill Nadeau always does a good job as our producer and phone answerer. And again, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, Jamie Knack and David Drake from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Thanks for joining us today. Questions about what you may be seeing in the out-of-doors or other issues as well, I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Send us your wildlife photos at ideas@wpr.org. That's our email address. Back to the phones. Dave in Greendale, your turn.
Hello.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question. I built a place in northern Wisconsin, and the heating and cooling people said not to put chimney caps on because they would frost up and then get blocked, and because the winters are cold up there, and the water comes out, hits that cold air. I just wondered if there's an alternative to that. And just as a side, I've got a modern system up there with intakes and, you know, out. And about two heating seasons ago, we turned on the heat and it didn't work. We called the heating guy. He came over, and in the intake, two flying squirrels had crawled down in there and blocked it. So the furnace started to go off, and there were two dead flying squirrels in the intake. And once he cleared that, it was fine.
Do you use this all year round, so you have heat on all year round up there, Dave?
We keep it heated a little bit lower when we're not there, but yeah, we keep the heat on all
year. Then it shouldn't frost out. It shouldn't frost out.
No, it shouldn't. And the type of chimney caps, you know, the ones that I'm most familiar with is they have some kind of a cross-hatched metal screen material, but there's usually about an inch or so gap in between the cross-hatching, and so that should provide enough airflow that it shouldn't frost up. As well, and for your intakes, if you take some harbor cloth, as Jamie mentioned at the front of the show, and just secure that over your intakes, that should prevent anything from coming in. And those flying squirrels are also cavity nesters, so that's why they're looking at that intake, because it's the diameter of that
perfect fit
for what they'd associate with the natural cavity. So, no, I think you should be okay with the chimney caps, It definitely is a better prevention than having raccoons or other cavity nesters in your chimney.
What kind of cloth is that?
It's like screen.
Yeah, hardware cloth.
Hardware cloth is like what you got in your screen door.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it looks something like that. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, you just want to make sure that whatever mesh size you use, the mesh size is small enough to keep out the animals you're trying to prevent from coming into that intake valve or wherever they're trying to get into your house. So hardware cloth is usually about a quarter inch mesh size. That's why we recommend it. Screen material works really well, but sometimes screen material can be fine enough.
A little bit too fine.
And it doesn't allow enough airflow, depending on what the situation is. And chicken wire also can work as long as the mesh size in the chicken wire is not so large that it allows mice and things like that to come in.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it. Let's take another Dave, this one in Waukesha. Hello, Dave.
Hey, Larry. I have a question. You were talking about repellents before, and I have a barn that I store hay in and a shed, and I have raccoons in there all the time. Is there anything you can do repellent-wise or leaving lights on or anything to keep the raccoons out? I've tried trapping them, letting them go, but they just come back.
So, Dave, that's a great question, and I certainly am sympathetic to the situation. I realize some of those old buildings are really hard to completely seal off. I will tell you, if you make the effort to try to seal off any openings, cracks, repair areas, it would be well worth your effort because it prevents them from coming in the first place. That being said, you can continue to trap and remove those animals, but it's a great habitat. You're going to probably have more come in. Folks that have a situation where they've had raccoons denning in an attic in a home have had some success being able to put on lights and blaring a radio to make it uncomfortable enough that the mother's relocated her young. Whether that is enough of a measure to deter, it's a balance for the raccoon on how great that habitat is and that location and what they're willing to tolerate for a disturbance. So the only other thing I would say, I'm sure it's there for the denning purposes, but if there's any type of food or other attractants in the building, to remove those or conceal them or seal them up in a different manner. But again, trying to add some more material or block the entry points to the barn would be your best bet.
The other thing I'll mention quickly, Dave, is if you're not interested in doing the trapping, if you go to the Wisconsin Trappers Association, there are trappers either in Waukesha County or in neighboring counties that would be interested in having access to a fur resource like raccoons and would come out and trap for you in exchange for that fur resource. So they would obviously be most interested during the trapping season when the fur is prime during the winter. So you might want to look at that website, Wisconsin Trapping Association, and see if somebody could help you trap as well.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Todd in Delavan would like to know if hummingbirds are now gone from southeastern Wisconsin. There's some late leavers yet, or Jamie?
Yeah, I think from from northern Wisconsin, they've certainly moved south. I think it's quite possible there's a few folks still seeing hummingbirds at their feeders in the southern part of the state. We always encourage folks to leave those feeders up for the next couple of weeks here in case you do have a straggler. And know that if you leave them up, you're not going to encourage those birds to stay longer.
No.
So leave them up for a few more weeks if you've had some visitors. That could be really crucial energy for their migration.
And Cy emailed to ask how a raccoon builds a nest in a chimney. He's curious about how they manage to stay up in the chimney.
Well, so if you've ever looked at the construction of a chimney, there's usually a damper, what's called a damper in there, and that's something that, or the flue, that, when you go to light the fire, you always want to make sure the flue is open because that's going to vent the smoke up through the chimney out into the outside. And so those animals will just kind of lay down, come all the way down the chimney to that damper or that flue, and usually that flue, whether it be open or closed, is enough of a surface area there that they can just kind of relax down there in that area. But, raccoons are just unbelievable animals in terms of their climbing abilities and their ability to kind of move their back feet, especially forward and backwards as they're climbing. And that chimney is usually rough enough inside the chimney that they can easily scale it. I mean, it's just like you and me climbing a ladder to get up to our gutters.
Yep, there we go. So another caller, Lowell in Barneveld. Hi, Lowell. Lowell, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay.
I've got a problem that's about to drive me out of the house. I have mice in my ductwork in the furnace system, and I have no way of finding. I mean, I've tried, but I can't find where they're coming in, how they're getting in the ductwork. I've had a furnace repair company come out, and the mice are actually dying in there, and really, literally about to drive me out of the house.
Yeah, I could believe that.
And the cat too. I have a cat, and it's making him crazy. And I've never had a mouse in the living quarters of the house in 13 years. Only in the ductwork.
Well, you know, a couple of things, Lowell, is maybe to look and see if I know there's companies out there that will come and clean out your ducts for you. And it's going to may cost you a little bit of money, but you may have one of those companies come and just have them sweep the entire duct system so that, number one, you can get rid of all the carcasses. So that will at least cut down on the smell and should help in that regard. But if they can't do it, maybe a HVAC, heating, vent, air conditioning type company has some type of a remote camera that they can run through your ductwork and see if there's openings in there that the mice are coming and going. And then they can just seal those up. That is probably the first place to start and see what's going on. And, you know, in parts of the ductwork, sometimes I know there are access vents. You might also just want, if you can easily access parts of your ductwork, you may just want to, for the next little while, have some mouse traps baited and set on a regular basis up in the ductwork and just check those maybe a couple times a week. And as you catch mice up there, just rebait the trap and keep it set until you don't catch any mice. And that will also be a good barometer, good measure as to whether or not whatever you've done to try to secure the ductwork, that if it's working or not.
Yeah, good tips. Thanks, Lowell, for calling. Appreciate it. And Linda in Wausau. Hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you today, Linda?
I have two questions. Well, one's a comment. I have a ventless water heater, and I had some rodent get in there because all of a sudden I turned my motor, the water, hot water on, and you could hear grinding. And then when the guy came out, he's like, ugh, a rodent got in there. So I just want people to make sure, because part of it looks like it was covered, but then you looked, and then you could see there were some slots that weren't covered with material to block the entrance.
Yep.
And I suppose it was warm and they came in.
Yeah, so you're talking about a tankless water heater, right?
Okay, a tankless water heater.
Yeah, water heater. So, yeah, those, and the reason I'm asking, those tankless water heaters, they're usually gas-powered, so you always have to have a gas vent outside, and you don't want anything. I know on our tankless water heater, sometimes if we get a big snowdrift, if the venting is not allowed, that the tankless water heater won't even turn on because of the gas buildup. So you do want to just make sure nothing gets in there. And again, that would be an example of taking some screen material, hardware cloth, and just securing it over the end of that vent on the outside of your house, and that should solve that problem.
And then I have another question. Like in the summer, I don't always see them, but I get groundhogs. Or whatever, all of a sudden you get different creatures in my yard. How do you get rid of those? Or what do you, I'm trying, they kind of go under this little house I have in my backyard. So I was putting rocks in any hole I could see, because they must burrow under there.
Yep. And so just to make sure that we're talking about the correct animal. So you're talking about an animal that you see a hole, maybe the diameter of a foot and a half or 2 foot opening, and there's a mound of soil in front of one of those opening holes. Is that what we're talking about?
People under my steps, or they burrow on the side.
I'm sorry?
But I see the rabbit sneaking under the steps of this little
okay.
house.
Yep.
But then it's like I looked on the side, and then I saw some burrows, like something must have burrowed under, because then I started filling that with rocks.
But do you see the hole, the opening to the burrow?
No, I mean, because it's like they're going under the house.
And then
I see. Yeah. Okay. So, the best thing to do is, number one, obviously you're going to have to get the animals out of there. And if you or somebody you know has a game camera, a wildlife camera, that probably be the best thing is set that up and try to pattern the behavior of that animal so you know when it's coming and going. Or alternatively, if there's some areas where you can rake soil, that bare soil, so you can see the animal actually leaving from underneath the house, or dust that area with flour from your pantry, just some way that you can watch the tracks of that animal. And once you see the animal leaving and you know that all the animals are out from under there, or if you can, push a rake or something under there and just bang it so you can try to scare the animal out if it's living directly under the shed, not in an underground burrow. If it's living in an underground burrow, that's a whole different story. But under the shed, if you can get those animals out and then take some type of barrier material like wire or fence or boards and block off underneath that shed so they can't get under there. If it's in a burrow system, that's more likely that truly would be a groundhog. And then you're going to have to use either a live trap or something like that to get that animal out of there. And then you can actually deal with backfilling the burrow. And if you want to go to wildlifedamage.uwex.edu, we have a fact sheet on groundhog, or also called woodchuck, management. And we've got a bunch of different management options there that will help you get rid of those groundhogs.
Good luck. Thanks so much. What was it again?
It's wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. All one word.
Wildlifedamage.uwex.edu.
Yes.
All right. There you go, Linda. Thanks for calling. And Sue and McGuanigal. Hello.
Oh, hi. I have a similar question, except my problem is mold. We noticed this late this summer that we have an infiltrator septic system, and by the vent pipe and by the inspection port, there was ground caving away and sinking. So we called a sanitarian, and she didn't think it was a problem with our septic system, that it was an animal. So then I called the DNR, and they thought it was mold. Now, we filled in one of the depressions, and I haven't seen any activity so far. So do moles eventually abandon, you know, their tunnels, or do they come back? We have not filled the second depression as yet.
Well, I think maybe the jury's out a little bit on whether we can be 100% conclusive that it was moles. That being said, the website that David mentioned also has a fact sheet on moles and compares mole burrows to ground squirrels and chipmunks or gophers. But typically moles will leave a raised ridge. So they still are burrowing underground, but in the manner that they do that, they leave a raised ridges all over, usually lawns, but certainly a septic system would fall within that. And they're invertebrates. They're there eating grubs and earthworms. And so they're making those burrows to forage, usually at night or during the night, and rarely do you see them above ground. So one question is, I mean, are you seeing exit holes when they, you know, they do still push dirt out of a hole?
No, we have not seen any exit holes. All we saw was the depressions. And the thing is, I don't have any of those raised mound-like trails, which is classic mole-like.
So I just wonder, I mean, it makes me at least wonder if there's an issue with the septic, that you have some erosion of soil underneath and it's caving in. For animals, even a muskrat that likes to den or burrow in the side of a wetland dike or a structure similar to a mound system, you're going to see that hole.
Big are the holes? Can you describe the size of the hole?
Well, see, it's not a hole. It's a depression.
Oh, okay.
The burrowing has caused the soil to sink. And so the depression is probably about 10 to 12 inches deep and maybe 18 to 2 feet wide.
Oh.
And the sanitarian said it doesn't seem the septic, the infiltrator septic system, the tile for, you know, where all the water goes, is 17 years old. And she said it'd be very unusual for that to be collapsing, you know, after 17 years. Initially, you know, if you first put in, you might have some, you know, sinkage, but not in this case. And so that's why I thought it was probably mold. Now, the thing is, we don't see any exit holes on the top of the soil. It's just all this burrowing underneath. And when we dug away, it looks like there was something digging, but it looked too small for like a woodchuck.
Yeah.
Well, Sue, one thought would be that, you know, this might be damage that occurred at another point in time, and it's caving in now, but the damage in the animal has moved on. So I think I'd be tempted to fill that area in and then pay attention to it. So once a week, take a walk over there, and or when you mow the lawn, you know, kind of pay attention to that area. So again, with moles, the method for removing them is either trapping them with a specialized trap that deploys below ground and kills them, or using toxic bait. Are usually the common methods, and in order for those to be effective, we need to be able to find the tunnels, and they need to be kind of in the surface area that you can get access to the moles.
I think it's more instead of moles from the description of it. I think it's something more that's a burrowing rodent, like a groundhog or chipmunk or 13-line ground squirrel, because those animals actually have a burrow system where they'll have rooms or areas that they kind of congregate in and they store food. A mole has more of a straight-line tunnel system, and it doesn't sound like that tunnel system would create that size of a depression.
No.
I think that it either was a groundhog or a chipmunk or a 13-line ground squirrel. And like Jamie said, it sounds like it might have been past damage, and just now that finally the substance of that area has finally collapsed.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks. So fill those holes in, those depressions in, and then see what happens, Sue. Thank you for calling. Mary in Ladysmith, let's go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Okay. I have backyard chickens, and this July, a little pheasant showed up, a ringneck pheasant female showed up. And she stayed all summer, and now she won't go in the house with the chickens. She stays outside. Do ringneck pheasants make it through the winter?
Ah, that's a good question. So they're an exotic species to Wisconsin. So they're from China and a variety of different strains. They are part of a put-and-take pheasant hunting program in the state where birds are raised and then stocked. And there was also a lot of experimentation with developing suitable habitat and being able to have native reproducing populations, or not native, but like naturally reproducing populations of wild pheasants on the landscape. That's been a bit challenging with the lack of conservation reserve program habitat for the birds, more fragmentation, predator issues, lots of issues that it's been difficult to have a naturally recurring pheasant population. That being said, where I am in Columbia County, the property that we're adjacent to, we do see wild birds year-round that are. So it's possible, but they really needs to be quality habitat, and mostly not just food, but also hiding cover, escape cover from predators. So depending on your surrounding area, she may very well stand a chance to survive the winter.
Yeah, she's kind of habituated to the feed, though, from the sound of it. So that could create a problem for her if there's no natural food supply in the winter.
Well, I feed the chickens, but what I'm trying to think is, should I build her like a little shelter of some sort, or catch her and keep her in the shelter? The chickens are out all day during the summer.
Well, because they're still a wild animal managed by the Department of Natural Resources, you really cannot legally take control of that animal or build or, you know, kind of possess it without a permit. So I wouldn't encourage you to go beyond feeding or to go beyond by building a structure or something like that. If it occasionally feeds on spilled seed at a bird feeder or something like that, and kind of incidentally, I think that's, you know,
fine.
That's fine,
yeah.
But I wouldn't go out of your way. What it does is it creates its dependency on you, and if you coop those chickens up during a cold spell in the winter and forget to put food out, it just keeps it relying on natural cover and food.
The other consideration, Mary, is I'm not sure what you do to inoculate your chickens, but obviously the pheasant, being a wild bird, is going to be exposed to different diseases than perhaps your chicken is, and the more the pheasant mingles with your chickens, there is a potential for disease transmission between the two species.
So a couple things to think about there. Mary, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake and Jamie Knack from University of Wisconsin Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guests Jamie Knack and David Drake from the UW Extension and from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Join in with your questions or comments, or maybe you've gotten a wildlife experience to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. If you got a great wildlife photo, love to see that as well. You can email us that, along with a question, to ideas@wpr.org. Nancy in Evansville up next. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, Larry. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Jamie and the outreach that she does with our youngest Wisconsin citizens to Grandparents University. Obviously, a wealth of knowledge and all this problem-solving, but also education for those kids to learn about animals and not be afraid. And I just so appreciate what she brings to the kids.
Wow, that's a very nice message.
Yeah, thank you very, very much, Nancy. That Grandparents University program is a program of the Wisconsin Alumni Association that I have the honor of being involved with. It's one of my highlights of the year. And it brings grandparents along with their grandchildren ages 7 to 14 to campus with the opportunities to explore various majors, of which I get to help them with the wildlife ecology major. And it is a blast.
I bet it is. Nancy, good. Thanks.
Yep, Jamie is a treasure.
There you go. Oh, well, let's go to Mike in Boulder Junction, find out what's on his mind. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call, and thanks to your guests. I'm retired from the building mechanical systems, and I know all too well the frustrations with red squirrels and flying squirrels and all the rest of them. But with our new condensing boilers and furnaces, the flute temperatures are running at such a low temp to get the efficiency out of these units that putting hardware cloth or anything over the vent, the boiler or the furnace or the water heater could definitely frost up if it's one of these condensing type units. And at the very least, a caller real early in your show that had a cabin, at the very least, he might end up with his pipes freezing while he's not there. And at the worst, usually there's protective devices on there that will shut them down. But you could have carbon monoxide poisoning.
Wow.
So it's something to think about, that we're not running these old appliances that shot really high flue temperatures out. And there's no simple answer to keeping the critters out of those things.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, I think that's great advice, and just, you know, creating that awareness. And I think that if somebody is looking to, you know, cover those access points or prevent access, it'd be good to consult with the company, you know, or a local contractor to just double check that.
Makes good sense. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your call and for waiting online to talk with us. Mark in Webb Lake, we'll go to you next.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have sort of an unusual problem. Twice now I've had a woodchuck in the engine compartment of my Honda Accord.
Oh.
Hard to trap because they eat dandelions in my yard. I've tried coyote urine and all these scents to try to keep them away, and they're still out in the yard. So if they can give me any suggestion, I'd sure appreciate it.
Mark, does that woodchuck have a driver's license by any chance? Because if not, I think this is a DMV. This is a DMV issue, not a wildlife issue. So, you know, the problem is, I guess you're parking your car outside.
I have one vehicle that I park outside, correct.
Could you put it inside, or is that not possible?
It's not an option.
Okay. Yeah, so I think... one thing I would do is maybe move the car, if you have any ability to move the car a little bit a ways away. The other option is to find out where the woodchucks are in your yard and try to trap them or remove them, either by humane relocation or by euthanizing them, and just try to reduce the groundhog population, woodchuck population, to zero in your yard, and that should take care of it. The other issue is, depending on how they're getting in, I'm assuming they're coming in from underneath the chassis.
Yeah, I've seen it, in fact, lay down on the concrete underneath the vehicle.
Yeah, yep. So, I mean, at the least they could do is give you an oil change or something while it's down there, right? But the other thing you could do is maybe if you're mechanically inclined, or go to a local mechanic and see if there's some way that they can put some kind of a barrier material so that they can prevent as many access points underneath the engine as possible without impairing the driving and the safety of your vehicle. That's something else to think about.
I have located it. You know, it's out in a wood pile. It's quite a ways from my home and the garage, and I put traps there, but I don't know how to bait it in there.
Yeah, so the key is, if you want to go to that wildlifedamage.uwex.edu website. We do have, a fact sheet on this species. But the key to trapping is to put the trap open near where the hole is that has the largest mound of soil in front of it. Bait it with an apple or plum tomato or something like that. And if you can cover the trap or enclose it, with old burlap or a blanket or a towel or something of that nature to darken the trap, that assimilates the burrow, and the animal's going to feel more comfortable going into that darkened trap than if the trap is wide open to the light and everything else for it to see.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And I was thinking about, I've trapped 11 of them off my backyard previous home once, and it was all in the summer. You can do it.
It's
a good idea to cover the trap, though, and make it seem like it's
a little more secure.
Yeah. And Christine in Madison, your turn. Hi, Christine.
I would like to know the most humane way to kill a mouse.
Yeah.
Well, Christine, some of this is a matter of kind of personal preference or opinion here, but I would argue the snap traps are very effective, quick, lethal cervical dislocation, so breaking of the spinal column, or the toxic baits. So the ones I would say are least humane are going to be things like glue boards, where you have to then still intervene, or drowning. And in the case of the Veterinary Association, you know, drowning's not considered a humane euthanasia for rodents. So I would say snap traps and poison baits.
Yeah, quick is the key for sure.
Yeah, I had a friend who had a mouse in a trap, in a spring trap one time that didn't die, and it was really awful.
Yeah.
So that's why my question more.
And I think some of that is just, you know, placement. So when you place that trap, you know, mice tend to run along walls. So instead of placing that mouse trap parallel to the wall, if you can put the trigger, the bait, perpendicular to the wall, so they can reach it no matter what direction they're running, you know, just kind of how you're setting the traps. But, you know, like anything, it isn't foolproof. I mean, you can...
But 90, most well, I time. Have no idea what I've said, but 98 times out of 100, that animal's going to...
They're effective.
And the other thing that, if for a resource out there, and we don't want to turn people off, because I know not everybody's in favor of killing mice or any other animal, but we do strongly stress humane euthanasia, and I know some people may see that as an oxymoron, but the guidance that we use is the American Veterinary Medical Association's 2013 euthanasia guidelines. And if you want to go there, that association has deemed what they consider to be humane euthanasia for a whole wide range of both domestic and wild animals. And that really are the guidelines that we use and follow closely.
And the humane method varies, whether you're talking about a small mammal, a medium or large sized mammal, a bird, that method varies.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And, you know, here we got fall migration in full swing. I talked to a friend of mine who's got a farm down by Janesville, and he says he's got like 60 or 70 sandhill cranes out there in one of his rye fields.
We have that right now, too, right in the backyard. We've got sandhill cranes. There's probably been 60 in there staging, come in every night, hear them bugling every morning.
Awesome.
It's just, it's wonderful. So, and cranes will stay here until... Well, through deer season is how I always remember, because I hear them.
For sure.
Yeah,
mid-November,
so end of November.
November, yep.
And they are we just dealing with the males right now, the juvenile males, or are they just all congregating now?
They're all staging up. Yep.
Everybody's staging up.
At
this point.
Yep.
Speaking of birds, can you tell us about the Bird Protection Fund for a minute?
So this is a monetary fund that is a collaboration or a partnership between the Natural Resources Foundation in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. And it's funded primarily through the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, which I know we've covered that in previous times.
Yep.
And the Birdathon is a fundraising effort where people during spring migration primarily, or breeding season, go out and they'll form teams, and it's kind of a fun competition, not only to see who can raise the most money, because each team tries to raise money that is donated to the Bird Protection Fund, but they also try to see which team can find the most bird species within a 24-hour period or whatever defined period of time it is. And so it is a really fun activity to get people outside birding. Passionate birders don't need much of an excuse to begin with, but it also generates quite a bit of money, which is nice. And then projects are demonstrated to provide a significant impact on Wisconsin's threatened and endangered bird population. So it's not the species that are doing well necessarily. It's the species that are rare or need some help. And so some of the things that they've done, some of the current bird projects that are being funded is Bird City, Wisconsin, the Kirtland Warbler Recovery that's going on primarily in the central part of the state up in Adams County in that area, Lake Michigan Waterbird Monitoring. But they do provide help for birds that are here in Wisconsin as well as wintering habitats. So they've got a Latin America Migratory Bird Habitat Research Project going on. So they try to contribute money for management and research down on the wintering grounds of Central and South America and things of that nature. And so Whooping Crane Recovery is another thing. I know we've got some information possibly on the Wisconsin Bird Atlas, the second atlas, and they've contributed money to that as well. So it is a very, very worthwhile fund, and I'm not even sure how much money they've generated, but it's several hundred thousand dollars, I believe,
been
established.
And again, how do you get involved with that? Or?
Well, the best thing to do is to, in the spring, is either form a team for the Wisconsin Birdathon or join a team for the Wisconsin Birdathon. And if you can't, either you don't have time or you don't want to go out birding, the next best thing is to contribute money to an established team and do it that way.
Yeah.
I've done that.
Yes.
I don't consider myself a great birder, so it's better, but I like birds, so
yeah.
It's easier for me to just to contribute to some to another team.
Well,
so.
And this thing about the birdathon, no matter how experienced a birder you are, people usually are very generous with sharing their knowledge and having new birders come and things like that.
Well, I tell you what, our two guests today, we're having a lot of fun with them. David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. We are going to take a quick look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll get back to you with your wildlife questions. So I hope you stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at the world of wildlife today. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack with the UW Extension and also with the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Always great to have them come by. And if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us your photos or questions at ideas@wpr.org. I almost forgot that. How could I forget that? ideas@wpr.org. There you go. Let's take a call. Lynn in Bayview, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I have two things. One is a question and one is a comment. So first, my question. I live near Humboldt Park, which is a rather large lagoon that draws lots of different species incoming in spring and going in the fall. And in September, three cormorants came, an adult female and two juveniles, and they stayed and stayed and stayed. They might still be here. It rained yesterday, so don't check it out. But I was wondering if they have time to migrate to wherever they go.
Yeah. There's a nice photo in the State Journal, the Wisconsin State Journal this morning of a cormorant with, I think, a bluegill in its mouth.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, so that's a double-crested cormorant is the species that we have in the state here. There are a couple other species of cormorants, especially in the eastern half of the United States. But, cormorants will have plenty of time to get out of here and go south. Obviously, what drives the migration in both spring and fall is the day length, the amount of sunlight. But then the other issue that are more refined factors is that as birds are flying south, for example, at this time of the year, if we have a south wind like we do today, we've got a pretty brisk south wind. None of those birds are flying today because they're going to be burning too much energy to try to fly into the headwind. So they'll just sit down and wait until there's a favorable tailwind, and that being out of the north right now. But cormorants are also an interesting bird. They've had a really interesting history here in Wisconsin where they're a native species. They were pretty plentiful, and then they started declining, and now they've come back to the point where they are viewed as a pest bird in many parts of the Great Lakes region.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I was fishing last week in Port Washington, and I saw one unlike Michigan flying as well.
Yeah, no, they're wonderful birds. They're neat to have around. Unbelievable efficient fishers themselves, and that's part of the, that's part of the conflict with the humans.
Yeah, that's fun. My second concern was I'm allergic to spiders, so I bought a product for eliminating spiders from my house, and it's just a little sonic device that I plug into outlets, and it minimizes. Actually, I don't have any spiders anymore, but it also, I put one in my garage, and it kicked out the mice. The mice left, and I don't want to tell you the name of the product, but I know it has 1.9 watts and 110 VAC, whatever that is. But I'm sure they all vary in strength and quality, but the one I have actually sends mice running.
Well, interesting. I don't know about sonic devices relative to spiders. Maybe if Phil Pelletieri or PJ come on next time, you can call them. I do typically know that there's not any empirical evidence to suggest that sonic devices are effective toward wildlife, and a lot of people use sonic devices for to get rid of moles, M-O-L-E-S, in their yard, or mice like that. And so if the mice left because of that sonic device, that may be just pure coincidence, but it may be relative to the sonic device. I'm not sure, but I do know that there's no scientific evidence to suggest these sonic devices work, although they are sold pretty commonly through the internet and other places like that.
Yeah. So, you know, people are always going to say, well, why doesn't she say the name of this? What's the name of the sonic device that you use?
It's called Victor Pest.
Victor Pest. Okay.
All right.
Victor Pest. And it actually, I always have, I have a very old garage, and I can't keep anything from getting in there.
Sure.
So I've had it for 2 years, and I haven't had a mouse since, and I used to have them every winter.
Like Jamie said, with some of the repellents,
keep doing it.
We tell people if the repellents are working, just keep on using it.
If
the sonic device is working for you, just keep on using it.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate the call. And Randy in West De Pere, your turn.
Yeah, I have kind of an unusual story about a possum. About 2 years ago in the fall, I had caught a possum in a live trap. And so I took it for a ride about 2 miles away and into a plowed field, and I shook it out of there, and it went for a walk for quite a ways out into the field, a good 5 acres, and it turned around and came right back and laid alongside the cage, the trap. So I picked up the trap real quick, threw it in the back of my truck, and I went home. The following fall, I caught a possum again in the same trap. Now, I did the same thing, took it for a ride, let it go. And now this fall, opened up the patio doors, and there's a possum looking in my window. Is it possible that's the same possum every year?
He's playing with you, that's for sure.
He must be in love with my trap.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. So I guess, you know, maybe to get at the issue of possums and wanting to you know, vacate them from your area. Are they causing a specific problem or getting into a garage or under a porch?
No, not really, not at all. You know, and I've heard that they're really good at eating mice and stuff like that and other rodents or whatever they eat.
Yeah, they're omnivores. They are kind of opportunistic foragers. So one thought would be, you know, we often have folks that get them in underneath porches that aren't necessarily closed off or in a garage that's been left open. That can usually be solved by some exclusion work. And the other reason people get them coming in is if you do have that spilled bird feed and they're coming in and feeding in the evenings on that bird seed. Maybe if you have, I don't know if you might have dog food that you leave out overnight. Those are all, you know, food attractants that are causing them to come and hunt around the area. I guess, barring any, you know, conflict, I mean, you could just leave them be in this case too. So, and I guess one thing worth pointing out, the 2 miles is probably not far enough for a possum for relocation. And not that I'm advocating for that. By state law, you cannot, trap and relocate animals without permission of the property owner. So if you have somebody who owns a farm and they're willing to take a woodchuck or a possum, no problem. You just have to have that permission. And we kind of look at it as, you know, it's hard on that possum too, to, get into a new habitat, find food, compete with, others of the same species and also avoid predators. So something to think about if you're not having any particular problems, maybe just cleaning up the yard a little bit. Maybe you just leave the possum there.
Yeah, there you go. Thank.
I might as well. He's in love with my trap.
He's just causing you more work and frustration. So
there you go, Randy. Thanks a lot for calling. You know, before we go back to the phones, there was something, and when I was introducing the show, we were talking about a specific turtle. We have a number of efforts to keep endangered species in the wildlife, in the state, I should say. What's the latest on the wood turtle before we go back to the phone?
Yeah, thank you, Larry, for a couple of minutes on this. This is happy to kind of highlight this project because we don't talk about reptiles and amphibians all that often. So wood turtles are one of the native species we have in Wisconsin. They are really interesting animals for a variety of reasons. But one of the things is we think about turtles primarily as aquatic animals. A wood turtle is a semi-aquatic, so they spend time in the water, also spend time on forested areas along waterways and things like that. And the wood turtle is a state-threatened species. It has got a pretty broad range throughout its entire range in the United States. It's primarily up in more of the north and northeastern United States up into Canada. But in Wisconsin, the wood turtle's range is kind of the northwestern two-thirds of the state, roughly. So think about that. And so the wood turtle is called wood turtle. The species is in sculpta, which means carved carved, I guess, is a good way to put it. So if you look at each scute or each panel on the wood turtle's outer shell on the back, the carapace, that each scute looks like the rings of a log. And yeah. So between that and the sculpta, the carved, that's why they call it a wood turtle. So wood turtles can live upwards of 40 years. They don't start breeding until they're about 14 years of age, 14 to 18 years of age. And so once they get to become an adult wood turtle, and they're at the largest, they're maybe a little shy of 10 inches long, something like mm-hmm. that. So once they get to be an adult wood turtle or large size, like an adult, they typically are doing okay in terms of fending off predation and things like that. But when they're young, especially as eggs in the nest or when they become hatchlings for that first year, they're vulnerable to, you know, roadkill and to predators, a variety of predators and agricultural practices and things like that. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, in collaboration with our department and some researchers and a graduate student in our department, the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, they have started looking at conservation measures to protect the wood turtle. And one of the things yeah. they're doing is to look at finding the nest and covering the nest with some kind of protective material so that, number one, predators can't get to the nest, but they can also contain the hatchlings in that nest before they disperse. And one of the things they're doing with the hatchlings is they're using epoxy glue, and they're gluing small radio transmitters onto the back shell of the turtle, and then following the turtles around for the first year of their life to try to figure out how many of these young turtles survive into through the first year of their life. And to get some demographics on them in terms of, so they can build what's called a population viability assessment, so they can start understanding how many turtles are breeding, how many are surviving if they're through their first year of life, and then they can start to build a population model to see about the viability of this particular population here in Wisconsin. So it's a really neat project. And it's a very worthwhile, interesting mm-hmm. animal, an animal we don't focus on too much. So it's exciting work and exciting to be able to share that project.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. And so anybody needing more information, where would they?
They can go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and if they just, in their search engine, they can search, just type in wood turtle. And if you've never seen one, they look like a kind of a historic, prehistoric animal.
Yeah, they're
animal.
Really cool.
Yeah,
they really look cool.
Yep.
Let's go to Alice in Hale's Corners next. Hi, Alice.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I'm a horse veterinarian, but I got a bunch of horses at home, and of course it's always an issue to have woodchuck holes. We're near a conservation area, and I don't like woodchucks out in my pasture. And I don't remember who told me this. Some years ago, a friend said, oh, we'll just dump really disgusting, dirty kitty litter down that hole. And they take that as a major housekeeping insult. And it's like they lift up their little skirts and tiptoe off, and then they make a hole someplace else. As long as they're not in the pasture, I don't care.
Well, Alice, that's great.
They run through my pasture as long as they don't, you know, I want their hole on the other side of the fence, and my woodchucks are pretty well trained because I think they're awful cute. I just don't want them, you know, giving me a hole the horse would step on.
Yeah.
And possums, you got to move them 6 miles. And I know that because for the longest time, they spread a disease for horses that can be fatal. And so as a horse veterinarian, you know, you hear about what to do about the possums. You got to move them 6 miles.
There you go.
And you don't want them anywhere near 6 miles of a horse property. We do have better medications for it now, but they are an issue for the horses. And that's where, you know, we learned about possum control.
Yeah. Well, I have heard that remedy with the kitty litter. So I don't know if that was somebody's excuse to try it, to have somebody else take care of their litter box, or where that came from. But I've heard that works as well. So
good for you, Alice. And 6 miles. Yeah, that's about.
Usually recommend, you know, a very busy 8-lane highway and a large river between where you relocate and where you've trapped it. But 6 miles also works, maybe.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. Dennis in Hartford. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I hope this isn't an issue that you've talked about so far. I just turned in a little bit ago. But I have a question on voles with a V in front. It seems like every spring of the year, my yard is all tore up with vole action over the winter months. And I'm wondering if there's any preventative measures I might take in the fall to prevent that.
Yeah, Dennis, that's a good question. So we are talking about meadow voles, most likely is V-O-L-E, and there's 4 species of voles in the state of Wisconsin, but especially in yards and suburban type areas, it's the meadow vole that is the culprit for that. And it depends on the extent of the damage. So what you're describing, where when the snow melts, is the vole, you see the vole runways on the surface of your lawn. That really is more cosmetic damage than it is anything else. And once the grass starts growing and the growing season becomes active, that will all fill in, and those surface runways more or less will go away if they don't go away altogether, even though the vole is still present or the voles are still present in your yard. So if it's just that, I probably wouldn't even worry too much about it because that is more of a cosmetic issue. Voles can do pretty significant damage to woody vegetation, and if they're damaging valuable woody vegetation plantings or other plantings like that, then maybe that's something you want to consider. But voles are active, especially the meadow vole, they're active year-round, and they are what we call subnivium animals, so they will operate or be active underneath that snow layer between the bottom of the snow layer and the top of your ground layer. And so ideally, if you want to reduce the problem in the spring, now's the time to start knocking the vole population down. And there really is no other way to do it. I mean, you can live trap voles, but it's not the most effective way to do it. So if you are going to try to enact some kind of solution, either bait mouse traps with peanut butter and then put those traps, the trigger of the trap, in areas where you see vole activity. You can use toxicants. Jamie referenced toxicants a while ago. If you do use toxicants, just please, to the extent that you can, collect all of the carcasses, because other animals will eat those carcasses, and you can get secondary poisoning through that way. But the time to really start to manage the vole population is now, not so much once winter is hit, because once winter is hit, your ability to manage that population is pretty limited based on the snowfall and things of that nature.
And Dennis, just one other thing to add too. I don't know how long you've lived where you have and how often you have this problem, or you see signs of the problem every spring, but vole populations do try kind of ebb and flow a little bit. So it might be something you just kind of tough out, you know, on those years as well, just kind of rake and overseed the grass areas. So it might not be something you deal with on an annual basis.
Yeah, and the other thing I should mention too, and that's a good point, Jamie. The other thing I should mention is, you can also try to attract predators in. So if you've got the ability to, you know, bring hawks or owls in, they're great predators in voles. Red fox are as well, raccoons and things of that nature. So where you have predators, they also can be effective in at least regulating that vole population for you. So you may not have to do as much, if anything, at all.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Lou in Prentice, we go to you next. Hi, Mary Lou.
Yes, good afternoon. I actually live in the southern part of the state, and I've got chickens.
And last Christmas, about Christmas time, something got into my chicken coop, dug under the ground somehow, came up into the chicken coop under the wire, and then killed my chickens. It would drag one chicken a day by the head and try to bring it through the hole. But the hole that the animal dug was only probably about 2.5 inches wide.
Yeah.
What animal did it, and how do I prevent my chickens from getting killed this year?
Yeah, Mary Lou, that is a common issue with chicken owners. Obviously, there's a lot of things out there that want to eat your chickens, from owls to hawks to raccoons to domestic pet dogs to mink and a variety of other type of weasel species. So from the description of it, what you're talking about, especially the size of that hole, I'm guessing it's either a mink or perhaps one of the weasel species, like a long-tailed weasel or something like that. One thing that minks and weasels do in particular is that they will sometimes surplus kill. So they'll come in and they may only eat one chicken, but they'll kill all the chickens in there in the coop. And the other thing that they typically do is they will attack that animal, the chicken, from the back of the neck at the base of the head. And sometimes, depending on how severe they bite through that spine, they can decapitate the chicken. So that's something else that would be a sign that it may be a mink or a weasel species. Owls also decapitate their prey quite commonly, but it doesn't sound like, from the description of how the animal got in, it does not sound like an owl. It sounds more like a mink or a weasel species. So the best thing to do is just to secure your fences, and you either may need to stake down the bottom of the fence or even dig a bit of a trench and then bury the fence into the trench and then backfill that trench.
Mary Lou, our family's been looking at getting chickens this next spring, and this is certainly one of the things that, you know, we have to prepare for, and it is a very common question that I get as well with all the urban backyard chickens. So, but in looking at websites, there's a lot of chicken coops that are built with the foundation all the way around having pavers or blocks of concrete. So if you can set that, either dig a trench and put pavers along around the perimeter of your run, that can make it very difficult for anything to dig because you've got a concrete paver there.
The other thing at night, if you can secure your chickens in the coop, because a lot of these predators are active at night that are attacking your chickens. So if you can secure them in the coop, that will also help. And if you have some bright motion-sensored lights around, that also may deter the predator at least somewhat.
And those small places, pens, why couldn't you just run, have some wire, hardware cloth, maybe not hardware cloth, but some sort of fencing right as a floor?
Yeah, you
or
can,
under the
yep,
floor.
You can certainly do that as well. Absolutely. Yep. The idea is you essentially just want to completely encase those chickens in fencing to some extent.
Yeah.
However you decide to
do
that.
You'd have to put some dirt over the top. They like to scratch and need to stay occupied so they don't pick on each other.
But you could. I hadn't thought about that, but that's right.
But you could backfill it.
For sure.
Yeah. Sometimes they recommend digging down and then putting fencing then making an L.
A flange.
So they can't.
So the mink and weasels are not true digging animals. They're not a burrowing animal. So what most likely is happening, even though it was around December, it was a mild winter last year. And so the soil, if it's organic enough, those animals will just scratch away and they can actually create enough of an entry point for themselves.
Well, with that, I'm sorry, Kathy, we didn't have time to get to you because we are out of time with our two guests today. David Drake, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison, a UW Extension wildlife specialist, and Jamie Knack, UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. They'll be back in a couple of months, and we will do this all over again. Thanks, guys, for coming by. Appreciate it very much. Tomorrow at this time, our consumer protection experts will be back to talk about the risk of ID theft for college kids, free credit freezes, and some other consumer information. So I hope you'll stay with us for that. But you know what? In the meantime, there's a whole lot more going on here on the Ideas Network. So I hope you will stay with us. And thanks for listening.